We'll hear arguments next in Hisham against King and Spaulding. Mr. Bondurant, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Next summer, we will observe the 20th anniversary of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It is ironic that after almost 19 years of the existence of that act, we are before this Court to discuss the question of whether or not that act applies to sex discrimination in the private practice of law in the most highly compensated and outside the judiciary, the most prestigious positions in the legal profession.
Highly compensated as compared to the judiciary?
I think I said most highly compensated and outside of the judiciary, most prestigious, Your Honor.
I see.
A
just
slight
a question
distinction.
Where you put the comma, isn't it?
I don't think the Court was misinformed as to the intent. The lower courts in this case held that because the respondent was organized as a common law partnership, acts of discrimination which the complaint alleges were practiced by that firm in the selection of partners were outside the coverage of the Act. Thus, even though the complaint specifically alleged and the lower courts accepted as true, as they, of course they must for purposes of ruling upon a motion to dismiss, that the firm engaged pursuant to a 100-year pattern in practice of discrimination against women in the selection of partners, the lower courts nevertheless ruled that that discrimination was outside the coverage of Title VII and that Title VII afforded the petitioner no remedy for that discrimination. Analysis of this case must begin, of course, with the statutory language of the Act. There is no question in this case that King and Spaulding is not an employer or a person covered by the Act. That is undisputed. It is plainly a firm engaged in the practice of law in the course of interstate commerce with 15 or more employees and with offices in two cities. Nor is there a question in this case as to whether or not Mrs. Hisham, an associate for almost 8 years with the firm, was an employee of the firm. She plainly was an employee as an associate. The question in this case, rather, is whether or not the particular acts of sex discrimination which the complaint alleges were practiced by King and Spaulding, admittedly an employer, against Mrs. Hisham, admittedly an employee covered by the Act, were themselves unlawful employment practices covered by Section 703 of the Act. We believe that the answers to these questions are in the affirmative. First, let me point out by stating that the petitioner agrees with the position taken by the Solicitor General, that it is really not essential in this case to reach the broader question of whether or not the partnership relationship, that is, the relationship between an individual partner and the institution itself, is an employment relationship. For reasons that we have set forth in the brief, we think an affirmative answer to that question is indicated in this and other cases. However, this case can be decided on the narrower ground that in her particular position as an associate of the law firm, the opportunity to be considered for partnership on a fair, equal, and non-discriminatory basis was both a term, condition, and privilege of her employment and an employment opportunity, both of which were explicitly within the protection of Section 703 of the Act and were, when the firm practiced sexual discrimination in making those decisions, were unlawful employment practices within the meaning of the Act. The complaint clearly and specifically alleged that the firm held out and represented the petitioner and to all other associates whom it sought to recruit the opportunity for fair, non-discriminatory consideration for partnership after completion of 5 or 6 years employment with the firm and hard and satisfactory work during that period.
Did they all become partners?
No, Your Honor, they all did not become partners. But the firm held out to the petitioner and to other associates the opportunity to be so considered. And by holding out that opportunity, the terms, conditions and privileges of her employment included the opportunity for fair, non-discriminatory consideration for partnership. When that was denied her, and that is what the complaint alleges, that she was not given fair, non-discriminatory consideration for partnership, the firm committed an unlawful employment practice covered by Section 703 of the Act, which is actionable under the Act.
But you would still be here if the ultimate decision was based on sex or race.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So the consideration isn't what you're really talking about, I don't suppose. You could consider all you want to, but if the bottom line is you don't get into this partnership because of your sex, you would still be here making the argument. But you'd have to say that the selection of a partner may not be based on that.
That is correct. And the process of selection.
Well, you're using too many words then. It's just that you may not select partners based on sex or race.
Certainly from among the associates, that is true. We also believe that that is true if one were considering partners from the outside, but that is not this case. This case is strengthened by the fact that the express representations of non-discriminatory consideration were made, and it is the opportunity for advancement which every associate possesses in his or her capacity as an employee of the firm, which is and becomes both an employment opportunity and a term, condition, or privilege of employment. It does not make a difference that the position of partnership is or is not itself within the coverage of the Act. For in the labor cases, this Court has recognized, as have the lower courts, that where a federal statute applies, as in the labor cases, and is violated, it does not make a difference that the opportunity for promotion is being withheld for an unlawful reason under one of those statutes, even though the position to which the employee would have been promoted was entirely outside the coverage of the Act. Thus, in this case, the complaint specifically alleged that she was possessed in her position as an employee the opportunity to be considered and to be promoted for a partner, that it was an opportunity for advancement, that it was withheld on the basis of sex, and it therefore is plainly within the literal language of Section 703 of the Act.
So if you win on that basis, if in hiring associates the law firm says that we will make our selection of partners unrestricted by the terms and conditions of Title VII, would that get them off the hook?
No, Your Honor, it would not. If the firm...
It isn't a term and condition of employment.
I disagree with you, Your Honor. I think the firm will be covered by Section 703.
So it's a legal term of employment.
I'm not sure what Your Honor means by that.
Well, I mean it's imposed by the operation of law, not by contract.
It is imposed by the operation of law. It is reinforced, whereas in this instance, the complaint alleges that the firm explicitly held out as an inducement fair, non-discriminatory consideration for partnership after 5 or 6 years of employment. In our view, it would not make a difference if the firm had been silent. That is, if the firm's business practices are such that the firm regularly reviews its associates and evaluates them for promotion to partnership and does so on a basis that is prohibited by Title VII, that would violate Title VII, even if the firm were silent in terms of the representations it makes to an associate.
Mr. Bondra, what part does the representation by the firm play over and above what the law otherwise requires?
Your Honor, it plays no part other than reinforcing the notion.
Well, if it plays no part, how can it reinforce?
Well, let me put it in this sense. We believe that if the firm were silent, that you would nevertheless be covered under Section 703. That is, that the opportunity for advancement, which one possesses as an associate, adheres in the relationship, and that where a firm regularly promotes associates to partnership from that relationship, that that is an opportunity of the employment and an implicit term, condition, and privilege of employment that could not be withheld on the basis of sex. That case, we believe, becomes even stronger where to induce one to enter into the relationship in the first instance, the firm holds out the opportunity for non-discriminatory consideration for employment after 5 or 6 years. If you were employed by a law firm and the law firm said to you, we make no representations to you whatsoever as to non-discriminatory employment, but nevertheless, the practice is to review and evaluate associates as they progress and to select from among those associates those who will be allowed to advance into the partnership and the remainder to be terminated by the firm. We believe that's a term conditional privilege in employment.
If so, supposing, do they still have that 15 employee limit on in the Title VII where people employing less than 15 aren't covered by it?
The 15 or fewer employee limit excludes business establishments with fewer than that number of employees.
Yeah, supposing a firm with 15 or fewer employees made a representation that we are an equal opportunity employer and we follow all the guidelines of the EEOC. Now, would that be actionable under Title VII, even though they had less than 15 employees?
No, Your Honor, it would be actionable, if at all, under state law, because Title VII explicitly excludes its coverage from employers with fewer than 15 employees. Hmm.
Mr. Bondurant, let's assume that the petitioner had been admitted to partnership in King and Spalding, and 2 or 3 years thereafter, young partners of the same rough age and experience were up for promotion within the firm to be entitled to a greater percentage participation. Would your position be the same?
Your Honor, let me answer it in two ways. First, that's not our case. This question is the denial of the admission to partnership itself and whether it's actionable under Title VII. Hmm. Secondly, under the broader theory which we advocate, it is our view that that would be covered by Title VII, that the question under Title VII is whether or not the relationship between a lawyer practicing with the firm and the firm itself as an entity is an employment relationship. That is, does it have the principal attributes of employment as a matter of economic reality? It is not a formalistic relationship, and therefore, if for the sake of a hypothetical, after 3 years as a member of the partnership, the firm should simply vote to reduce a female or black partner's earnings to zero as a method of excluding them from the partnership, having been compelled to admit them in the first instance under an order of the court, it is our view that that would be independently actionable under Title VII.
You've touched on 2 or 3 different factual situations. Your answer is that with respect to any change in status within a partnership, down through the years, any partner may claim discrimination on the basis of sex or race.
Well, not quite any partner. The partner must first be within the protected group.
Don't go quite so fast. What's the answer to my question?
The partner, if the partner were within the protected group of persons covered by Title VII, if the partner believed that there was a causal connection between the decision made by the institution itself affecting compensation, terms, or other conditions of employment,
Now,
it would be actionable under Title VII in our view.
You're saying that a partner is an employee of the firm always?
We're saying that for purposes of Title VII, the relationship between a partner and a law firm has sufficient attributes of employment.
Well, can't you just answer that question? We are dealing with the issue whether or not Title VII applies. It only applies if an individual is an employee. Now, is it your position that a partner, once a partner, always is an employee for purposes of Title VII?
For purposes of Title VII, the answer is yes.
Yes. And every year when participation is reconsidered, the firm would be confronted with this sort of a litigation?
The only consequences, Justice Powell, of applying Title VII to either the admission decisions of partnership or the compensation decisions of partnership are to outlaw prohibited forms of discrimination. It is our view that that is not going to create a great disruption within mm-hmm. partnerships. It is not going to diminish the quality of the legal profession, nor is it going to diminish in any way.
What's that got to do with the issue in this case?
The question of compensation at some later point, in our view, Mr. Chief Justice, it is not this case. This case is whether or not Mrs. Hishon, in claiming that as an associate, in the first instance.
Well, is it relevant whether your view of the case or your friend's view of the case would enhance or do otherwise to a particular law firm or to law firms generally? Is that relevant?
Your Honor, it is not relevant other than as a broad policy consideration to reinforce the applicability of Title VII to law firms. Lawyers, after all, as our adversaries point out, occupy a rather unique position within the community. But it is that position, we suggest, which advocates for and not against coverage of Title VII. It is more important that excluded minorities progress within the legal profession than in any other capacity, because lawyers are in a unique position to influence the course of events in ways that businessmen, bankers, corporate vice presidents, and other people, all of whom are covered by Title VII, do not have the same capacity.
Mr. Bondurant, would you concede that judgments are made with respect to a variety of qualifications when the partnership decision is made?
Absolutely.
And many of those judgments are subjective.
I would also concede they're subjective, just as they are in the question of whom an ordinary business enterprise would employ for a particular position, particularly one of higher than a menial capacity.
So it's possible a firm may need somebody to do damage suit litigation, and if an individual in competition with that associate was very good at corporate law, would those factors be considered?
As long as none of the prohibited factors covered by Title VII were factors in the decision, the firm is free to provide and apply subjective criteria in determining who to admit to partnership and how to reward those who it has admitted to partnership. But it is our view that sex is not one of those factors which affects that decision-making process, and that Congress has specifically proscribed that as a factor.
And one more question. Suppose a law firm needed a new tax partner, and the word got around, and a half a dozen people, established tax lawyers, applied. I'm talking now not about an associateship, but about a partnership. Title VII apply?
Your Honor, under the broader argument which we make, we would take the position that it does apply, but the court need not go so far as to decide that question in this case.
Well, I asked you whether it would apply, and you said the answer is yes.
The answer is yes. The considerations may be subjective. The proof problems for the lawyer claiming that because he was Jewish, he was turned down as tax partner in a large law firm may be difficult, but they are not insurmountable, and they do not take the claim outside the coverage of Title VII. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal unless there are further questions for the court.
Mr. Bautor.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the government's submission in this case is quite straightforward, and we ask the court in this case not to decide the difficult question whether and to what extent partners may ever themselves be regarded as employees of a partnership. On that question, the government has not taken a position. We feel that whatever view one takes on that question, Mrs. Hishon's complaint in this case stated a good cause of action under Title VII, because Title VII clearly and sharply provides that women employees may not be treated worse than male employees, the statutory language, that there may not be discrimination with respect to the terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. Now, as an associate, Mrs. Hishon and the other associates of the firm were concededly employees, and her complaint alleges that she was treated worse than the male employees with respect to a central element of the employment relationship, one that is absolutely critical to every young lawyer at a large firm like King and Spalding.
Mr. Battelle, I hate to interrupt you so early, but it would help me if you could tell me, perhaps this is not a fair question, does Title VII apply to the faculty of a law school?
Yes, sir.
And what about the tenure decision? Does it apply to that?
Lower courts have unanimously held, and the government's position has been, that the tenure decision is covered by Title VII.
Are any cases so holding?
There are cases.
Are they cited in your brief? I just haven't seen.
They are cited in the Second and in the Third Circuits. There are cases so holding, or at least so assuming. There are cases that, of course, go into the question whether on the particular facts.
And so that would apply all the way up the line to associate professor, to full professor, to chair professor.
Yes, sir. The opportunity for advancement.
To the dean.
If a law firm excluded women from consideration for dean of the law school, I believe that Title VII would be violated.
Well, what about intake at the very bottom in the law firm? How about hiring?
I believe that it is universally conceded that in hiring associates, a law firm may not exclude. In fact, one of the peculiarities in the position that Mr. Morgan has before this court is that he says at the hiring level, where you're bringing in associates, you cannot exclude women. But in effect, he says, you can hire them for a different and discriminated against slot, that is, for a lesser consideration, when you get to the partnership term. So I understand the position of Mr. Morgan and the respondent in this case. It is that the law firm is wholly free to adopt an explicit rule, for instance, that women will be considered for partnership after 10 years, but men will be considered after 6 years. And he says
what
the
about
titles,
lateral entry to partnership?
Directly into the partnership? That is the question, Your Honor, that the government
is withholding its position.
It has not taken a position.
Bator, is there anything in the legislative history of Title VII to indicate that Congress intended to insulate decisions regarding the selection of partners from Title VII's provisions?
The selection of partners from the outside.
Right. Or?
From the inside.
From the inside. Either way.
There is nothing directly related to law firms. The legislative history is very clear as of 1972 that a central concern of Congress was access of discriminated against groups, women and blacks in particular, to the higher professional, managerial, and elite positions of society. And that issue was very centrally canvassed when an amendment was proposed that would have excluded from Title VII the choice of doctors to practice on the staff of hospitals. And Congress rejected that amendment precisely on the ground that it is that kind of highly sensitive position as to which Congress was especially keen that discrimination should end. Now, in that respect, to us, it seems quite irrelevant whether partners themselves are associates. We're quite willing to have the court assume, for purposes of this case, that partners themselves are not employees, that they're owners. Like stockholders, it's clear that if a corporation with 10 stockholders wanted to find new stockholders and went out and sold stock to new stockholders, that Title VII would not have anything to do with the case. But if that same corporation makes the ownership of stock part of a stock plan for employees, then it cannot ration that on sexual or racial grounds. It can't say we will only admit men to the stock option plan. In other words, ownership is not employment. But if ownership is distributed to the employees as a regular practice, as one of the elements of the employment, Then Title VII cuts in and says you cannot do it on a racial or a sexual basis.
Well, could you have it? I take it then the government would say that law firm couldn't take sex into consideration at all, even for affirmative action purposes or for quota purposes.
In promoting
entry to the partnership.
Our argument is restricted to the proposition, Justice White, that insofar as admission to the partnership is a term and a condition and a privilege of an employment relationship. So if there were no employment relationship theretofore...
Well, I know, but I'm talking about this case where there was an employment relationship, and the law firm says, well, I think we ought to have six or eight lady partners, but no more. Or we should have 20 or 30, but no more.
Your Honor, that, I guess, would become then subject to the more general and obviously very sensitive question of whether rectifying previous discrimination, to what extent affirmative action or other plans would be prevalent. But that, we think, would cut into the general background Title VII law as it applies to ordinary situations. That is, there would be no special rule with respect to law.
Professor Title VII apply to a situation where a woman or any other person claiming the protection of the Act pointed out that for 10 years that she had been in the firm, she had never been assigned a case to argue in the courts of appeals or the Supreme Court, and that was an area reserved for men, that would be the claim. And in fact, the record would show that only men have been assigned to those assignments. Would that be cognizable under the Act?
Yes, if she's an employee of the firm, I think...
Wait a minute, a partner now.
Oh, she's now a partner.
We've got over the hump.
She's now a partner.
Now we have a partner.
That is a question which I'm unable to answer, Your Honor, because it would depend on this additional question whether the partners themselves are employee. I should put this qualification on that.
Your friend said the partners are employees.
Yes. We have not joined the petitioner in that submission. The government is arguing this case on a narrower issue, which is relates entirely to the way in which King and Spalding treats its associates. And we're saying that for that purpose, it's irrelevant whether partners are themselves employees or owners, or whether you pierce the partnership veil, as it were. Now,
Professor,
with respect to our submission...
May I just ask you another question? In the year 1983, with a third of the students in the law schools of the United States, is this really a problem? And I ask one supplemental question. If you're a partner in a law firm, you're very careful about selecting new partners because it affects your profits. In other words, you want the strongest possible person regardless of sex, color, or race. That may not have been true 20, 30 years ago when people had lots of prejudices they don't have now. But I can't imagine a law firm deliberately discriminating against somebody if the firm made a judgment that the individual would increase the profits of the law firm.
Your Honor, this may be a decreasing problem, but when Congress acted, first in 1964 and 1972, it was a very active problem. It was really a virulent problem. And that's the time as of which that statute speaks. So the fact, and to some extent, that it is no longer a problem is itself maybe a product of Title VII in the background. That is to say, since everybody concedes that at the intake stage, when young associates are first hired, Title VII does apply, of course, law firms have had to accustom themselves to overcoming these ancient prejudices. And they have learned, we have all learned, as we've learned on faculties, that in fact the prejudice was simply inexcusable. And that really, I think, pushes me into what is my last point with respect to Mr. Morgan's submission.
You're now using your friend's time.
No, I think I will back off and leave my friend this time.
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Morgan.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The petitioner, in brief particularly, and here discussing 20 years as of next year on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, has made a point of whether or not King and Spalding and lawyers are above the law, and whether or not the case of respondent would place them there. I submit that it wouldn't. Of all of the professions in the United States, and probably of all of the sundry people who perform services in our society, lawyers are the most regulated. However, from time to time, there are certain kinds of activities that lawyers find necessary for their work. For instance, the privileges that are granted with respect to the attorney-client privilege, the fact that lawyers can state things in courts that are at least qualifiedly privileged and often have absolute immunity from libel.
I'm not sure that I grasp what you meant by the statement that they're the most regulated. Regulated, which regulation are you speaking of? The structure of the bar or the potential of a particular court?
The structure of the bar, as well as the structure of sundry courts that lawyers are members of the bar over a period. Bar associations, first of all, do regulate lawyers. Lawyers are regulated on entry into the profession, all the way through it and all the way out of it, often not as much as they should be, but certainly more than other professions, it seems to me. And as such, it's a question, not a question of are lawyers above the law, but it is a question of whether or not the Congress intended to cover them by this law. And it is secondly a question as to what protections lawyers are granted by the society and by the law and by the Constitution in order to perform their necessary function in the society. Now, we submit to you that lawyers are entitled to the highest degree of First Amendment associational freedom. We submit that, and we think that Congress understood that at the time that it enacted the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You'll note in our briefs that we've discussed the existence of lawyers in Congress, the large number of them, and the people involved in the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the number of law partners in Congress who didn't talk about lawyers and law partners but did talk about doctors when they made the points that are made in briefs about professional coverage, and the fact that those lawyers in Congress certainly had in their minds the fact that they were lawyers. Now, they wanted to eliminate, I believe, based upon only one statement in the record, a 1963 statement by Congressman McCulloch, they wanted to eliminate discrimination in the employment of professionals. Senator Javits and others discussed questions with respect to hospitals and the elimination of employment of discrimination with respect to people being able to practice medicine in hospitals. Congressman McCulloch mentioned law along with other professions in 1963 in a preliminary report. But when you turn to the year 1964, there is only one statement involving partnerships in the record of the debates, which the New York Times termed so voluminous that the weight of them was gigantic. And that one statement was made by Norris Cotton, Senator Cotton, and he was commenting on the fact he was speaking against the provision to lower the coverage to 20 of employees to, at that time, as I recall it, 25. And when Senator Cotton was speaking, he said, why, this would be so absurd. When you have that small an operation, it's almost like a partnership. Now, that's it as far as the record is concerned. There's nothing in the Solicitor General's brief. There's nothing in the petitioner's brief. There's no other intention of Congress to cover law partnerships.
Well, what sort of a partnership do you suppose Senator Cotton was thinking of coming, as he did, from New Hampshire?
Well, he came from New Hampshire, but he was also, as I recall it, the senior partner in the law firm, in a law firm in New Hampshire. Cotton, Tesrow, I've forgotten the name. We've spelled it out in brief. I think he was thinking of that partnership to start with, his own, because he was, after all, a partner in a law firm at that time.
But a lot of the partnership problems that you advert to in your brief seems to me are covered by the 15-employee requirement. You know, if you're talking about a small partnership.
Are there any 15-member law firms in New Hampshire?
Well, sir,
You know they're not, don't you?
There might be one, maybe two, but I certainly don't know. I haven't spent a lot of time in New Hampshire.
Mr. Morgan, you yes. do concede, though, I guess, that the law partnership of over 15 associates is an employer of the associates within the meaning of Title VII, don't you?
We have not taken a position to the contrary. We have not taken any position.
Well, I'm asking you now.
You
surely agree that it is an employer under Title VII of the associates.
It is an employer of associates under Title VII, which poses certain problems for a portion of my case. For example, if King and Spalding or any other law firm employs lawyers who then sue King and Spalding, there may be an invasion of the attorney-client privilege. According to petitioner, law partners and associates do the same thing. There's no difference between them. Therefore, why shouldn't a promotion system take place as though the law firm were a corporation? And if that took place, it would just be kind of a stair-step progression from a GS-8 to a GS-15 to a GS-18, which must be a partner. Now, their contention, then, is based upon the fact that the employees of the partnerships are clearly spelled out in the statute. There's hardly a way to take another position than the one that I just took. It says partnerships are employers. It doesn't say they're employees. Certainly, if a partnership's an employer, it's very difficult to figure out how partners would be employees.
Well, we don't have to decide that, do we?
Well, I think when looking at congressional intention, you have to see what Congress had in mind. And Congress.
No, but the petitioner in this case says you don't have to decide that. All you have to do to decide this case is to decide whether the associate is an employee, and therefore is fair consideration, without regard to sex, a term or condition of that employment.
Well, in response to Justice White's question, he stated, of course, should be here anyway, going right into the firm. Now, their position, both petitioner, one of petitioner's three positions, and the position of the Solicitor General, their position is that terms, conditions, privileges of employment, that covers a promise to fairly consider an employee or a prospective employee at the time of hire, and then 6 years later you're supposed to enforce it. Now, let's see if that's what Congress had in mind. Because first of all, the rules of construction say that no words in the statute are surplusage. You have to consider the entire statute. Now, first, it's the Equal Employment Opportunities Act. It creates an Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. The Solicitor General states that if there's either a pension plan or he was talking about a stock option plan with a corporation, that it would have to be treated equally for everybody, and I agree with that. But in this particular instance, where you have terms, conditions, privileges of employment, and you get into those words, you run squarely into the rest of the congressional intention, which is clearly stated in the following way. It says, and it defines people. When it gets to members, it's talking about labor organizations, not partnerships. When it gets to, it shall be an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discriminate. It then goes on, with respect to terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. Now, remember, these outsiders they were talking about bringing into the firm. And King and Spalding has many of those. That's in the record. There is no set way here, as Cravath, Swain, and Moore had in the Lucido case, coming straight up, where they took in nobody to the side. Now, with respect to this particular case, petitioner would say you need go no further with respect to the ramifications of your decision. You need not even think about remedy because we do not want to be in the partnership. Therefore, just consider it my way within this structure. It strikes me that's not the way the court should do business. I think you have to think about the ramifications of it and what the true intention is. Another phrase. It shall be an unlawful employment practice. Talking about employment practice. It says that a person can't limit or segregate or classify his employees or applicants for employment in any way which would deprive any individual of employment opportunities or otherwise adversely affect his status as an employee. Now, that's what petitioner didn't like, was a status as employee. Now,
may I ask you about the hypothetical question that the Solicitor General gave? Supposing the firm had a rule that male associates are eligible for partnership after 6 years, and female associates are eligible for partnership after 10 years. Would that comply with the Act? What is your view of that?
The Act is not applicable to partnerships, so consequently they could do that.
That would be a permissible disparate treatment on the basis of sex.
It would be permissible as a disparate treatment if they just did that. Let me give you an example.
They write it out. That's the rule. Sure. When you come here, they tell the women you'll be eligible in 10 years, and they tell the male employees you'll be eligible in 6 years.
Put it in the employment booklet, just like it's happening all over the country now, as these job right cases are developing under state law. Employers, some of them, except for those who are frightened of doing it, are putting on the face of it. You should understand you acquire no rights when you come here.
My hypothesis is that you require, if you're a male, you acquire the right to be considered for a partnership after 6 years. If you're a female, you acquire that right after 10 years. Now, why doesn't that fall right squarely within the language of the Act?
If I lay it out when the associate is hired,
right,
and I tell the associate at the time of hire that later the associate will have to work here for 10 years before the associate can become partner, well, I think we're assuming something that not even, of course, the complaint says. But as far as the
position, I think, has to say that in the eighth year, the male and females are not being discriminated against, are not being treated differently on account of sex.
I'm saying two things. One, if I say that outright as the partnership, I just tell folks, whether I tell them in writing or tell them orally, and I just say, look, it takes 8 years for women to get to be good lawyers and 6 years for men to get to be good lawyers, and then we're going to consider them. The answer is, did Congress entitled to cover the partnership decision? My answer is no, not under Title VII. Might there be an action elsewhere? Sure. Could the action be brought? Sure, but not under Title VII. And the second answer. If you take Justice Powell's statement about why in the world would a partner want to keep out someone who's going to make him a profit, which happens to be the theme of petitioner's case, petitioner says, good heavens, lawyers, law firms are businesses, and we're making all this money all over the world, and that's the central theme of law practice. If that's the case, then any law firm which would make such an averment of 6 and 8 year differentials to employees at a law school in the United States from which they hire would be laughed off the campus and promptly would go out of business.
Mr. Morgan, on this, carving out this exemption for law firms, with the number of law firm representatives in Congress, why didn't they spell it out? If they intended to do it, they knew how to spell it out, and two, they were lawyers. Am I not correct that every member of the Judiciary Committee in the House is a lawyer?
Yes.
And they drafted this bill? Now, how can you say they didn't mean to cover lawyers?
Well, sir,
that's your position.
That's my position. It was so obvious and so apparent that three decisions of this court surely would apply. One of them is, of course, Catholic Bishop Secondly, a second decision that would apply would be Yeshiva, because they identify. And the third decision would be Bell Aerospace. You know, Congress can sit over there, and they can't think of every crazy thing somebody's going to bring up. And if they did, then they'd write an exception in for that. But in this particular instance, Congressman McCulloch, chairman, himself a partner in a law firm, Congressman Seller, who had been with a law firm previously. It may have been at the time, but he was previously. And partners in law firms sitting there, some of them, could never even conceive that anyone was going to come and say, well, we're going to make partners under Title VII.
You mean out of all the partnerships that you can imagine, the law partnerships were alone exempt, or are you suggesting that all kinds of partnerships were exempt?
Well, I'm suggesting that as far as Congress was concerned, all of them were. There's higher protection to law firms and accountants, and there were more lawyers. I was talking about lawyers because lawyers are in Congress.
So your submission really is that no partnerships are covered by this insofar as entry is concerned?
Sure.
Into the partnership.
Sure. There's no question about that in my mind. That's what Justice Goldberg wrote right there within two or three or four days of the passage of the Act in his concurring opinion.
So we should judge this case as though this were a partnership of engineers or rather than lawyers. So can't we just forget it's lawyers?
No. If we forgot it was lawyers, we'd be like Congress forgetting to write an exception.
But I understood Justice White's question, and your response has confused me. Are real estate partnerships, banking partnerships, medical partnerships all in the same category under Title VII, whatever that category is?
No, sir, but in most of those you do not... Are they all in the same category? Yes, sir.
I thought you answered me that no partnership was subject to Title VII in terms of entry.
Yes, that's what I'm... But let me complete that. No partnership in terms of entry. However, that question is not before the court. Well, the question that is before the court, because no constitutional questions implied with most...
But your submission, as I understand it, would cover any partnership.
I beg your pardon?
Your submission would cover any partnership. The rationale for your position...
Oh, no. I think, in the first place, assuming that all business partnerships have a right of commercial association, then they would be covered, and they would have a lower standard of constitutional rights with respect to what is done to them by the government through the EEOC, which would assume jurisdiction, than is a law firm, which is an advocacy organization, if there's ever been one.
Well, do
that's why law partnerships are different from other partnerships, and that's what's before the court.
Well, what cases from this court support you in suggesting that lawyers have this very high claim to resist government regulation because they're advocates?
Oh, no. That's not... What we say is that law firms are advocacy organizations which handle litigation, as was pointed out in NAACP versus in Button. In the Button case, we talked particularly, the court did, about use of litigation to political ends. Law firms certainly are constantly petitioning Congress, petitioning for a redress of grievance in court or out of court, and doing those things that are clearly protected by the First Amendment. Now, that's what we say about the advocacy rights of law firms. As far as whether or not that gives them a higher standard of protection, surely it does. When a question is asked in an interrogatory such as here by the plaintiff, which could be asked by the EEOC in the case preceding.
Well, so supposing that Congress is not trying to deter advocacy expressly at any rate, it's saying that lawyers or law firms are going to be subject to minimum wage laws. Maybe they have to bargain collectively with representatives of their employees. They're subject to the Civil Rights Act. Now, I wouldn't think that any of those things raised any constitutional question whatever.
As I recall it, on the minimum wage, they would come off as a professional exemption. But
well, let's assume Congress decide to repeal a professional exemption.
All right. As far as the purely business and economic aspects of law firms, to wit, Fair Labor Standards Act and the minimum wage laws, think you're right.
Well, but we're not dealing with purely business. You apparently feel there's some higher, loftier goal of law firms than making money. And even let's put in that higher, loftier goal. Now, why can't Congress do just what it wants to with respect to law firms, with minimum wages, civil rights, collective bargaining?
Because what it does is it takes in this particular instance and places an advocacy agency of the federal government overseeing the law firms. The case you just heard before this case involving EEO-1 reports. In that particular case, let's just, law firms file them too. They don't file partners, the numbers of partners as employees. They just file associates. Now, the EEOC decides to go against a law firm. It has a subpoena power, and it can subpoena the law firm's documents. In this particular case, King and Spalding's responses, as are contained in the record, say, in the district court, say, she didn't get along with our clients, in effect, amongst other things. And those are the reasons we didn't admit her. Now, at that point, they've asked an interrogatory question. And the interrogatory question goes directly to the questions of, what matters did you handle for clients? What matters did she have problems with?
Okay,
who do you represent?
That assumes that lawyers in their dealings need confidentiality in a way that lots of other organizations don't. I dare say Shell Oil, which was the party to the prior case, probably has a lot of papers they would like to keep from the government about hiring decisions in their top echelons. But I don't think they've had the effrontery or perhaps ambitious visions of their business yet to say that the Constitution prevents the government from doing it.
I certainly hope not. But lawyers are different. Lawyers are essential to the enforcement of the Constitution. Let me give you some examples.
Well, Mr. Morgan, now Congress knew full well how to write exemptions from Title VII, and it put in three. And you're asking us to just produce another one out of some abstract concept about lawyers. If Congress had intended to have this exemption, wouldn't it have said so?
No. Congress did not exempt lawyers from their hiring policies.
That's precisely what we're talking about.
Congress exempted partnerships as employees and partners as employees. We raise the question of the First Amendment to come under Catholic Bishop and other cases to demonstrate a rule of construction with respect to the statute, which says that the statute should not be interpreted in such a manner as would require a restriction of the constitutional liberties that do attach to law firms with respect to the performance of their duties. And it doesn't matter whether it's the lease case with respect to Mr. Justice Stevens and Mr. Justice Brennan talking in terms of going across the country and lawyers almost having a due process property right and the right to practice and their higher motives being involved in the representation they do. Justice Brennan talking about NAACP versus Button, that it was not the Equal Protection Clause that mattered. It was this, like a firm of lawyers.
There's a little difference. NAACP was a non-profit corporation.
But you see,
Your client is not a non-profit.
I hope not.
If it is, I'd be ready to say you're in bad shape.
It is. Nobody want in. Now, let me just mention to you from NAACP.
Before you leave this subject, what difference does it make to your case and your arguments whether the proposition you're advancing applies to medical partnerships, real estate partnerships, and engineering partnerships? I thought your argument was that a partnership of any kind is a consensual arrangement, and governmental power can't intrude into consensual relationships, and I had understood that was about the theme of the Fourth Circuit, was it not?
The 11th Circuit. That is our argument. Our argument goes beyond that because law firms are involved as First Amendment-protected entities. That's the only reason we've brought in the First Amendment. We don't say that the statute's unconstitutional in its application. You don't get to that under what we interpret.
You haven't mentioned the right of association, which we have said is guaranteed by the First Amendment.
We go into it in depth, in brief. Yes. We do talk about it. And when I go to that associational right, I go to the Button case, and I go to Justice Brennan's words in there. And it says the protections of in Button would apply as fully to those who would arouse our society against the objectives of the petitioner. Expression, for the Constitution protects expression and association without regard to race, creed, political affiliation, truth, popularity, or even social utility of the ideas and beliefs. Now,
does that apply to stock brokerage partnership firms in New York?
As far as partnership coverage of Title VII, yes, the same rule would apply to them. As far as the rules that apply to lawyers, no.
So they can exclude all women and all minorities?
In their partnerships. Yes.
In their business?
In partnership, yes, sir. If they're a partnership, they can do so.
What you want us to do is to write an exemption that Congress didn't write. And then there'll be people, I wouldn't say you, but there'll be some people who say we're legislating. Is that what you want?
Well, sir, if...
Do you want us to legislate?
I think that what we're talking about here is not you legislating it, but since there's not a word in the record of Congress that they desired to cover partnerships as anything other than employers...
There's not a word that says that they didn't intend.
Only one sentence that would indicate it, and that is Senator Doris Cotton, and he comes close to saying... This is crazy, folks. This would be as bad
as doing it. Well, you can't really say there's only one sentence. The Act itself doesn't exclude lawyers, law firms, and these associates are employees, and you concede the law firm is an employer. So that's, we don't need to go to legislative history, do we?
It excludes partners as employees by including them as partner, as
well,
employers.
That may be so, but the government's position doesn't go to whether a partner is an employee. It is a much narrower ground that the associate is an employee and part of his terms of employment is fair consideration.
I understand the government's argument.
What if it were perfectly clear on the face of the statute or the legislative history that Congress intended to cover law firms and intended to cover the admission of partners? Let's just suppose it was clear as a bell, and would you be here arguing it was unconstitutional?
Oh, yes, I would.
You have to say that, I suppose.
I would really say it. But you see, I understand the problem with the phrase. It's not a popular thing to say, but let me tell you why I think that. If you take Ferry versus Ackerman, which came out on the Criminal Justice Act of 1964, considered by the same Congress at the same time, their desire was to maintain the independence of lawyers from government. Mm-hmm. Now, that desire happens to be something that you go under with the EEOC, a government agency, going after law firms which litigate against them. And I know, as some others do, that there are times and places in this world when a lawyer defending people, sometimes unpopular and sometimes unpopular causes, had best be able to select his own partners, because if he can't or she can't, he's not going to be on the firing line defending the rights expressed by the highest court and the highest ideals in our country.
Good show.
Did you have anything further?
Good show.
You haven't mentioned the right of association, which we've given a very high place to in our opinions. Is the right of association impeded or infringed on in any way?
Not in this case, Your Honor.
If they're compelled by some legal process to take on a partner in a consensual relationship?
Your Honor, the aspect of the case is a consensual relationship is a red herring. A contract is a consensual.
Wait a minute. You say that the consensual aspect is a red herring?
It is a red herring. Takes 42 U.S.C. 1981, the right to contract, which cannot be withheld on the basis of race under the 1871 Civil Rights Act. A contract is inherently consensual. There has been no question of Congress's power to override the consensual aspect of that in order to enforce a more important provision of the Constitution. Secondly, and perhaps even more fundamentally, this Court has never placed value on the right to discriminate on invidious bases in either the admission of black children to white schools. The Court never thought that the white children had a right which overrode the rights of black children to equality of education, to be free from that association. The worker on the assembly line, the Protestant had no right to exclude the Catholic or the Jew from working side by side on the assembly line. And in the law firm, the partner who is a male has no right to exclude the female from enjoying the same opportunities in the profession. The First Amendment has never protected those rights. The only associational First Amendment protection this Court has ever recognized was the right to join together to assert other First Amendment rights. And that simply is not implicated in this case. Justice Powell mentioned the profit motive, that it is inconceivable in 1983 that one motivated by profit would turn down a competent partner. The same argument could be made for every business enterprise in this country, that they would turn down a more qualified person if they were truly motivated by profit. But your experience and mine has been that they have done it. Profit was never the question. And Congress laid that question to rest in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It decided that profit motives and moral suasion were never effective in rooting discrimination out. The Heart of Atlanta Motel case, a motel that was within a stone's throw of both King and Spaulding's office and my own, is a typical example. Why would a motel have empty rooms when it could rent rooms to blacks and turn down the profit opportunity which that presented? It did, and it defended that right all the way to this Court. And Congress decided in passing the Civil Rights Act that the profit motive was not sufficient to bring about the eradication of employment discrimination in this country. Your Honor has asked about other partnerships. First, we do not believe that the investment partnerships are implicated by this case. The opportunity for two or three people to form a limited partnership to buy a piece of land in rural Georgia is not what is at issue in this case, because that is an opportunity to earn a return on capital investment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...